Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, Griefsters. I hope you're having an okay week wherever you are listening. Thank you so much for downloading this episode of the Griefcast. This is season 10 of the Griefcast. I know, absolutely staggering. Thank you so much for joining me, continuing to join me on this conversation of grief and death from various people from all walks of life. I have mentioned it a few times, but I have a book coming out. It is coming out in January. It's called You Are Not Alone, as I say at the end of every episode, and it is published by Bloomsbury Tonic. Now, you can pre-order it in all the usual places. If you think you are probably going to buy the book anyway, please do a pre-order if you don't mind. It's very helpful for me and the book. It really helps the various book places know that this book is a popular book. So I would hugely appreciate it if you've ever found the podcast useful or helpful in any way and you think, yeah, I am going to buy that book, then a pre-order would be massively appreciated. If you've already done it, thank you so much. I'm really excited about it. I am really excited. It's everything I've learned from the show and quotes from the show and all that sort of thing all put down in one place. And I think it's genuinely useful. That's that bit done. Thank you for listening. This week, I'm very excited to talk to the incredible, the amazing. She's one of the grief elders, guys. She's in the gang. It is the fabulous writer, Kathy Rensenbrink. Kathy is just, she's up there for me, you know, with the Julia Samuel, the Helen McDonalds, you know, the Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie books about grief that you need to read. Her incredible memoir, The Last Act of Love, came out a few years ago now, and it is, yeah, it's one of my favourite grief books. It's just, she just gets it. Her writing gets it. She's written lots of other books as well. A Manual for Heartache, which is a broader look at not just grief, other things, how to survive this world. Dear Reader, The Comfort and Joy of Books. And she has a novel as well, Everyone Is Still Alive, and a book about writing as well called Write It All Down. She's brilliant. She's amazing. I've really loved her for a long time, and I was a bit chuffed. That's the only word I can think of. Really chuffed when she agreed to come on the show. Kathy came in to talk to me about her brother, Matty, who the book The Last Act of Love is all about. And yeah, we just chatted grief. I hope you enjoy. So who are we remembering today?
We are remembering my brother, Matty.
And I know you have written about Matthew in your, I think it was your first book, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. That's right. Yeah.
The Last Act of Love. So how long ago did Matty die?
Well, a very long time ago. I mean, it's complicated because he was knocked over by a car and then he never regained consciousness, but he was alive for another 8 years, which was just awful. So I never feel, when I think about how long ago it was, I tend to date it for myself from, the night when everything changed was the night when he was knocked over by the car. And then the next 8 years were basically a really long death. So that was in 1990 and I was 17 and I'm now 49. So I'm not very good at sums, but I think if I've done the sums, I was thinking about it this morning. So it's 32 years ago. And then in lots of ways, does feel completely immediate.
Yeah.
Like it feels like it was sort of nanoseconds ago.
God, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? So how old was he when the accident happened?
He was 16, so he was a year younger than me. Well, he was 13 months younger than me. I used to like to say 13 months younger than me and 9 inches taller than me. And he was very, he was really funny, apart from everything else. He was sort of smart and funny. And yeah, I mean, I just loved him very much in a really uncomplicated way, because of course I didn't almost know then that I was, I wasn't particularly aware in lots of ways how fortunate I was. I wouldn't have said, if someone had asked me the morning of the accident, I probably would have, I'd have probably been preoccupied with, what my boyfriend was doing that annoyed me or whatever. Yeah. I wouldn't have said, like, I've got this great life with these wonderful parents and we live in this pub in Yorkshire and I've got this amazing brother and everything is so brilliant. That's one of the things about grief, isn't it? I think that recurs again and again and again. People say, I didn't know how happy I was. I didn't know how lucky I was.
Oh, no.
So I didn't really know that. And then that's when I've come to think of it actually as a, as a guillotine, as a blade, as a separator, that night he got knocked over and life as it was just became, it was just a different thing from then on.
It's so, grief is, like you said, I think guillotine is a beautiful and hard metaphor, but true. Your life is so completely different, but especially when it comes with your situation, when it is a sudden accident, because it literally, from that moment, whereas I think my dad died of cancer, so you've got like all this other, like when you got the diagnosis and then when they got sicker and then when they died, it's a sort of, like you said, this slower process, but because of what happened to Matty, it's such a, I guess, a clear point in the timeline of when everything disappeared. I thought what you were saying is so interesting about just happiness, because it's a real cliche, and I don't, it's really hard. Sometimes I think you just can't know how happy you are until something goes, because you think, oh, could I have done something differently? Especially at 17, you just can't really appreciate these things because you don't know what it's like for any alternative.
No, you don't. And I think you can't as well. I don't think it's almost like appropriate. I don't want to run around to... there was a stage where I thought, why did nobody warn me that it was possible that life might do this? Why did I not know? Like, how could I not know? And then the more I think about life, the more I think that's almost the point of it. It sort of has its way with you, and you can't know, and nor would you want to anticipate, you know. Think about it, a lot of my son, I've got a son who's 12, and of course he does know much more about death and disaster than I did, partly because I think I finished the book when he was 4. And so, of course, you know, my professional life then became about talking about what that book was. And especially because of the pandemic and doing Zooms at home. And because he comes to festivals and he meets people. And so he's just very aware that he's where people die and people are sad and he knows all that stuff. But again, I don't want him to almost like know it too much, if you see what I mean. I don't want to feel that our job with our children is to prepare them for the fact that terrible things happen. But it's hard, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really hard. I can really, really relate to that, because I've got, two small kids, and I obviously do a podcast about death, and the younger one doesn't have a clue, but the older one slightly knows. I mean, and she knows that obviously she doesn't have a grandpa and he's dead, and then my husband, both his parents are dead.
Mm-hmm.
So she's aware, but I find I can't lie about it. So I worry exactly like you're saying that I'm over preparing for her. But like in that terms of like when I hear a parent say like, I'll never leave you, I think, well, yeah, you hope so.
I hope
that won't happen. And I can't, it sticks in my throat. And I always find I have to say things like, I will do my best not to leave you. But like, you know, I love you. That's what matters. Like I try and steer it that way, but I can't promise the things that I feel like I was promised. Everything will be fine, of course, nothing bad will ever happen, because my parents were like, oh, don't be silly, you know, everybody's fine. And they also were unaware of what, you know, what was around the corner.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting. Yeah, I think you should, I mean it's a really big thing for me. I don't lie to Matt, so if he I don't force conversations on him, but if he asks me anything ever, I try to find an age appropriate way to tell him the truth.
Yeah.
And and I think it's really important. And a friend of mine said, actually, that he changed what after... I think I'd written about this somewhere. I can't remember whether it's in the first book or in one of the others. But a friend of mine who'd read that said that it changed the way he spoke to his kids. Because I think his youngest child at the time was very nervous, kept saying to him, Dad, promise me you won't die. And he kept saying to him, I promise. Then he read the thing I wrote and then started saying, actually, that's not within my control. But what I promise is I really love you. And actually, that love does last, even if something really bad happened. And I mean, I don't know, I'm not saying I write about it, but I just think it's an important I feel it's an important principle. And I think it's, again, what, how are we serving our children? I think it's like a really broad thing about the way we bring up our kids, that we feel that in the face of loads of evidence to the contrary, we've got to sort of sell them this perfect life full of plastic dinosaurs and fluffy toys and nothing's ever going to go wrong. We're surrounded by loads of evidence at the moment that loads of things go wrong. Things are really unfair. And I think it's kind of, I don't know, it doesn't serve them to pretend about it. My father-in-law died when Matt was about 18 months, and in some ways I think it's quite good that he was, you know, he was at a funeral before he really knew. And it was quite cute, and there was this, he got confused, so he's Dutch, my husband, so Opa, grandpa, was what Matt called his grandfather, right, Opa. And he would say, again, in that way that kids do, they're very direct, say, Opa's dead. And I said, yes. Then there was this misunderstanding, because he thought Opa was in Devon. So that was good. And what I thought at that funeral, actually, again, which was in Holland, and I felt that the Dutch were less squeamish about death than we would have been. You know, like my father-in-law was in the house for a few days, which would have happened in this country a couple of generations ago.
Doesn't
anymore. And it was, you know, again, it was weird that he was there, but it was also kind of beautiful. And then, you know, my son and his little cousins walked behind the coffin, and I thought, actually, maybe it's not just that we shouldn't try to pretend to children that death doesn't happen, but actually their function in this is that they are cheering us all up.
You know,
my little niece Joanne was scattering rose petals, and there was something about the presence of the children that I thought was really beautiful. Because again, it is that thing, isn't it, that it does, I think we have a real tendency to treat death and grief as kind of like inconvenient party poopers, you know. This isn't the consumerist promise. How's this happened? This isn't supposed to be happening to me. I'm supposed to be, you know, I'm supposed to be going off in this direction. I don't want this to happen because I've been promised that if I just like buy the right stuff, everything will be okay. And, you know, not true.
Yeah, I think you describe it really nicely, and I think that's what I'm always trying to get across when I do talks or anyone asks me about it, not in the club, inverted commas, of like, you're not saying every day is doomed and awful, but like that it's going to happen. It just is going to happen. I think, yeah, the idea of it, party boomers, of like it's something you can control, or something unfortunate that happens to people who have bad luck, you know, like they didn't read the right book or do the right thing, or they weren't careful as well. Like, we love to believe that if we follow all these magical rules, we'll be okay. And the idea that it's like, yeah, just fucking happens. And kids at a funeral is interesting. My mother-in-law, my what's the word, niece, I was gonna say cousin, she's not my cousin, my niece, was there. And it was tricky. I think she was about six, and it was hard. But also, I agree with you. It offered, sounds so corny, but it did offer a hope of like, oh, there is life, isn't there? And there's joy, and there's a person here who doesn't really understand, so is running around and treating it like a party. And I think what that does is, it reminds you of the two truths of grief, that you can be devastated and at the same time still enjoy something. Like, it's not a permanent state. And when you have a kid at a funeral, and obviously it's very personal, not all children would want to do it or understand it, but I think it is, like you said, the idea of not being squeamish about it, which I do think, yeah, particularly British English culture is. And it's not just us. I've spoken before, like, I went to Sweden and did a gig there for Griefcast, and they were worse than we are. They were absolutely awful. Like, they just couldn't even say the name of the podcast. It was like, oh, Griefcast. Like, so I was heartened that it wasn't just us. But it's nice to know that the Dutch are more more on the other side of, like, you know, it happens.
Yeah, they have that. I think Dutch people in general have that sort of practical, matter-of-fact vibe about them. I'm half Irish as well, so I've been to quite a lot of Irish funerals. And the way my dad is, again, around it. Though I do that thing, I never know. I didn't really grow up surrounded by other Irish people. So, like, my dad is Ireland for me, and Ireland is my dad. So I'm inclined to think that, like, everybody in Ireland is like him. They might not be. Maybe he's just very emotional and likes laughing and crying a lot. but I think, when I think back to my own childhood, you know, so my mum's dad died when I was 9, and I remember it so strongly. I remember her crying in the bath, and I remember us talking about it. And I remember, and again, now when I look back on it, not that I think she was particularly aware of it, but again, she was sort of kind of slightly training me for when I had to talk to grief about, you know, when I had to talk to my child about grief. And then I remember, again, I remember my dad's, you know, someone in Ireland died really, like, suddenly and really sadly. And we went to the funeral, and I remember, I think I was 14 then, and I remember my dad was distraught. But again, I don't think it was a bad thing for me to see that. I don't think that was a bad thing. And again, it's a big Irish funeral and the open coffin and loads of people wailing. And I remember this thing where there were so many people, it was a bit overwhelming. And I slightly got almost like, it was like almost a crowd.
Yeah.
And I kind of almost like got kind of caught in this crowd and was sort of slightly being carried away almost from my cousins. And then I remember one of my cousins, he sort of reached out and he said, "She's family." And there was this rope surrounding the family, this rope kind of dividing the family from the sort of general mourners and well-wishers. He said, "She's family." And then someone kind of ushered me the other side of the rope. And then that really became a metaphor for me forever, this thing of whether or not you're behind the rope. Where are you? Where are you in the setup? And I remember thinking, something in me felt a bit, you know, I knew I wasn't affected by this. So although I was allowed behind the rope, I knew this wasn't my tragedy. I knew it wasn't a tragedy for me like it was for her children. I knew it wasn't a tragedy for me that it was for her siblings. I knew it wasn't a tragedy for me that it was for my dad. And then, of course, and I really remember it when Matty was knocked over. I remember at some point very quickly, I thought, well, I'm behind the rope now. I really am behind the rope now. And I think it's that thing, isn't it? But then you can't undo it, can you? You kind of just, you know, you're in the club, you're behind the rope, you're at the grief party, you know, it's kind of...
I really like that though, because I've often heard the expression, or I've used it, like, it's like a bomb blast, and like sometimes you're at the epicenter and you're looking at it, and sometimes you're like, oh, I heard it, I was around the corner, and so I'm scared, I'm afraid, and I'm affected, but I'm not, as you said, affected. And I've definitely, different griefs, you do sort of know where you're at from the epicenter, don't you? Because you can be like, oh, I'm very sad and I knew them and that's sad, or I'm, if it's, you know, I'm behind them. I am really, I'm not even close to being carried off into the crowd. Like, I'm by the coffin.
Again, I think it kind of behoves you as a bereaved person to kind of have a sense of that, of help. You know, I've been in a few situations in more recent years where I've just supported someone who is behind the rope. Mm. And it's been very clear in my head that in this situation, I'm not, you know, how I feel about it doesn't really matter. My job is to support this person who's in this role. But I mean, because so many things about death are so funny, aren't they? And I do think that one of the things, I mean, funerals are very funny. And one of the things that's funny is that there is kind of a terrible humour when, because you do get those people that just sort of over assume, want to make it all about them.
Oh, the professional mourner who turns up. Yes. And I remember that at my dad's funeral. It was like some people like unable to speak to in such a state, and me being like not crying, you know, and me thinking, oh, I think that's what I'm supposed to do. Like, that's my, you've got my costume on. Can I have it? But you know what it's like as a human. If someone is more emotional, often you become less emotional because you're like, oh, you seem very upset. Maybe someone should get her a tea or something. Like, even though it's like your dad has died. You're like, oh, are you okay? And they're like, oh, he was so wonderful. You're like, yeah, I know. He was my dad. Okay, it's very... And I think actually we've talked about this in the show as well, like the further away you are, it's easier to cry. Like often, as we've said, like people lose their emotion, lose their shit at like a pet dying or someone they didn't know very well, because it's like gives you this like safe space to go, all the grief can come out. But actually often what you're dealing with, which I'm sure you must have had with Matty, is like shock of like, what just happened? Did you, I mean, he was on life support, is that right, for 8 years? What was the situation?
Yeah, so he never regained consciousness, really. So he was in it's called a persistent vegetative state, which is just a horrible collection of words, which basically just means really brain damaged. He was basically as brain damaged as it's possible to be without being dead, really. And in the early years, we obviously had a lot of hope that he would somehow get better. So in a funny kind of way, that wasn't, I don't know, it was a very active time. And then later on, it was sort of about 4 years in for me, when I just realised in a flash, which I think it was because I'd been to France for a few months. And then came home and walked in. We'd like built this purpose-built extension to the pub so that he could live in there. And I just walked in and I just thought, actually, like, I think the distance just basically let me see how fucked up it all was. And in that moment, I just knew, like, well, he wouldn't want this. Mm. Which had always been felt, again, that's something I feel squeamish about, actually, saying it's what he would have wanted. General, you know, that again, I think sometimes people claiming to speak for the dead or for those who can't speak for themselves, I think I'd probably always been a bit over scrupulous about not wanting to speculate. But it was really clear to me in that moment that it was just sort of mad, really. But we kind of carried on for a bit. Of course, there was my parents and me, and we all, I think, came to a decision at a different time about it. Mm. And then eventually, after another couple of years, we went through the family court and had to petition, effectively. I can't remember what the word is. Basically, get people agree that to his lot that his life could end. And that was, again, they do it differently now, because I think we were the 12th case. And, of course, nobody... I don't see this in any way of blaming anyone that involved. Nobody knew what they was doing. And of course, it's interesting, isn't it, how even psychological awareness has moved on so much, I think. Well, you know, one of the good things about society is we've got a much better idea of what you should and shouldn't ask of people. So, I think I was, when I look back on it now, I was really screwed up by having to write down an affidavit that I wanted my brother to die. And I think now they just don't, because you feel really complicit, that's the thing. And I did think he should die, but again, just to have to do that, and without any kind of care or without anyone else saying, this is a complex situation, it's not surprising.
Yeah, and you don't mean it, you're not saying it. It's like, it's not someone to hold your hand and be the law is making you do this, but technology is also at play here, because we have, like you said, we now have the ability to keep someone in that state, which 100 years ago wouldn't have happened. And it's so much stuff that a human being should not have to write that down.
I think it's like a cruel and unusual, that's the thing, that we've, our technological ability outstrips our moral, ethical, legal, emotional ability. And then I think we were kind of caught in the, you know, being in those early days, there just wasn't any sense of the potential impact of doing it, you know.
Yeah.
And I think now, well, I know that now when it happens, there's more support for people. And someone would have said, oh, you know, someone would have said to my parents, send that nice daughter of yours for some therapy. She's falling apart. She's going mental. Do something with her. She doesn't know what to do with herself. So nobody did say that. And I just tried to kind of carry on, kind of being, you know, genuinely surprised that I did feel, I mean, I've never doubted it was the right thing to do. I just utterly, completely know that. So there wasn't any doubt. The other thing as well was, which turned out not to be true, I really thought because I had grieved so much, I mean, sometimes it felt like I'd spent 8 years pretty much in tears or drunk, which isn't quite true. But I mean, I kind of, when I wrote my first book, actually, I remember saying to, the thing about it being repetitive, because basically, and then I got drunk and cried myself to sleep, was just like the thing I could say pretty much every day for 8 years. And I thought I must be empty. I kept thinking I was gonna, I kept thinking the reservoir, the internal reservoir of tears.
You think I can't do anymore. There can't be anything left. There just can't be.
Yeah, there is. You know, and then I was like, oh, and also that it was new, that there was a new texture to this grief of not having him in the world, and not knowing what to do with that. Of course, for me, I think writing my book about it was such a significant thing. So I'd just never been able to almost like get out from under it. I found it such all-encompassing, oppressive thing. And so writing my book, I think, was again, complex, but a really good thing. And I learned lots more about it because of writing my book. And actually then had loads more really good therapy. It feels more in the past than it ever has, but it still also feels, in lots of ways, very present to me. But I've reconciled with that as well. I've accepted that. I think it's that thing of, I think I used to hope that I would somehow be restored to factory settings, I could be rebooted. And that, because again, one of the very unhelpful things people say about grief, all that, you know, time's a great healer and it'll take a year and all that sort of stuff. And I realise now that none of that's particular. I don't think grief is a linear business at all.
No, not at all. And it's really, I really feel for you, because not only is this extremely complex situation and unusual, but to be 17 when this kicks off as well, because I was 15 when my dad died, and I know that feeling of like, I don't quite know what's going on because I'm just not old enough. So I just don't quite know, and I don't have the words, and I have a lot of feelings there, but I don't really know. And then you sort of think, well, the best thing to do is try and just pack this all up into a box, I guess. It's very messy. Shove it down, because like nobody wants this. And you're just so desperate to be normal and get back, like you said, to, you know, BC, before death, before you knew what all these things meant. And to have that extended grief for 8 years, like that's really, I mean, now, you know, there's all these terms of delayed grief and anticipatory grief. Like you must have been having all of that, because he was there, he's not there. You're, like you said, there's this situation with, I remember that in the book so vividly, of like you describing this situation, the extension and the, you know, all the machine, the mini hospital that you create.
Yeah.
And we had that with my dad, and actually both my parent-in-laws like died at home. My dad did, but it was very brief. You know what I mean? It was like they had cancer, so for like a month, there's a hospital bed and handrails are installed, and then suddenly they're all taken away again, and you're like, oh, a minute ago, this, oh, okay. Like, but to have that for 8 years is a long time. It's a long time to carry that, and to start the journey at 17, I think is hard. It's really hard. I don't know what kind of 17-year-old will, but I know from my being 15 of like just not really understood. Like I felt like 80% really made sense, and then there was this other chunk where I was like, I don't quite know. What do you mean he's dead? Do you know what I mean? Like, what is that? I know it, I get it, but also, what? Because there's, you know, people spend their lives wrestling with the concept of death and endings and all this. And when you're a teenager, you're like, I really don't have the full vocab. I haven't downloaded the full application yet, so like,
yeah, definitely. I think that's, and I suppose as well, I often thought like it was such a big percentage, like sort of 17 when he was knocked over, and then I was 25 when he died.
Yes.
So out of that first 25 years, you know, of my life, especially when we don't really remember the first bit of life, like just so much of it was that. But yeah. I feel that's something that somehow, I don't know whether it was writing the book or it was having the good therapy or whatever, but I used to get very, I don't know, just kind of think, I definitely have more of a sense of what happened. At one point, like, I didn't know anything about myself before the age of 17. I couldn't remember anything about what ordinary life had been like.
Wow. Yeah.
And I couldn't actually remember Matty before. I couldn't remember his original self. And somehow, writing the book, I feel, I've got that back, and I have. I remember somebody saying to me at some point that it was better to have loved and lost and never to have loved at all. And I just thought, I don't think that's true.
Mm.
I would so much rather have just not. I can't cope with this pain. I just don't, you know. And I didn't think I'd be able to have a child because I didn't think I'd be able to, you know. And over time, actually, I now would say it's better to have loved and lost. Yeah. And I think it's, from my perspective, I'm really glad that I did have my brother for the years that I had him. But, you know, it's taken me a couple of decades to get to that
point. And that's the thing of, like, I think when you're at the start of this journey, I hate the word journey, but it is, like, when people say things, time heals, you're like, fuck you. how is this useful? It's like someone being like, you're hungry, and you know what, in 20 years I'm going to give you a sandwich. You're like, great. But I agree, I'm 20 plus years, and you can see, oh, what they mean is it just takes a long time to feel not healed, but to, you know, resolve all those feelings and to feel all the pain and to put it in your life in a way that makes sense to you and carry it. But it's very, you know, that doesn't make for the snappy bon mot that everybody wants to, like, hand to you. And yeah, I can see someone saying better to loved and lost is... The thing is, though, and what I'm obsessed with is the two truths. Two things exist at the same time. Like, I'm very glad that I had 15 years with my dad. Like, I'm, you know, I've interviewed people who have had less.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel it does make you think, God, I'm lucky in some ways. But you know what? I'm also sad I only got 15 years. Like, both those things exist in the same breath. And I think sometimes people are so determined to, like you said, make the linear narrative, or like, this is the truth, so it's better that you had him then you never had him. You're like, yeah, but also I miss him. Like, they're in the same bracket, and it's all there together. And I think that's what happens with time, is you're able to go, oh, I have both those feelings. But at the beginning, you're like, what's the truth? Is it a bad thing they happened, or I'm lucky that it happened, or I shouldn't feel any sadness, or I should only feel sadness?
And I think that is something... Again, given our teenage, you know, the nature of our teenage selves, that I think is something that comes with wisdom and maturity, isn't it? That knowledge that this is true, and this is true, is true, rather than like, this is true, so this can't also be true.
Yes, yeah. I was so binary with my thinking as a teenager. Yeah. It was like, that's who I am. They're dead. They're dead, and I'll never mention it again. It doesn't matter. That's done. Finished. And then you realise, oh, you're not finished. You're never finished. You know, you always keep changing and evolving.
Yeah.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd. And did you say, so your son is called Matthew?
Yes, he is. And I didn't, that wasn't my intention, because I've always thought, to be honest, it's a little bit gruesome to call people after dead loved ones. And then when we went for the, you know, the bit where you go for the scan and they, you know, that you've got, and I'd had a miscarriage. So the last time I'd gone for a scan, it was to find out that the baby wasn't there. So it felt very, very emotional. And then just at the moment where the sonographer said, you know, when I sort of realised everything was okay, and it just utterly felt, it just felt like the right thing to do, really. It's also my dad's name. So again, it felt a little bit like, it didn't just feel like I was sort of naming him after my dead brother. Yeah. What we said was we'd call him after both his grandfathers, so Matthew Jan. And also it's my brother's name. A couple of times I've wondered whether, but again, he became a great catalyst, really, Matt, for me exploring it and writing the book, which of course I had no intention to do, because now understanding what I do about narrative, it's very confusing. So I'd known I was going to write a book about it. I'd definitely have given him a different name. But he was I think this is the thing with me and my parents, we talked about nothing else but Matty for those 8 years. And then after that, I think then there was a time when he became a secret. He became a, you know, it was all so painful, and we kind of tiptoed around it. Again, it's like it's that explosion metaphor again, like we would set off a mine if one of us accidentally put a foot in some sort of area. And then one day my dad was telling a story and really rarely mentioned my brother. And it was because it was this time they went to the Helston boating pond and the canoe sank, and my granny was on the land saying, "That's my son-in-law," and my mum was saying, "Shut up, mum." My dad was really hungover and had been trying to get to the pub for a livener, and it hadn't happened, you know. So my dad was telling the story, it was all quite funny, and Matt was in the back of the car, and then he looked at me and he said, "Was there another boy called Matthew?" And I just thought, like, the sort of the beauty of that. And then I just said, "Yeah, there was." And then that was part of me really realizing I'd have to come up with, you know, because over the years, I think the other thing as well about something happened to you when you're 15, 17 or whatever, people are still asking you a lot about your family, aren't they? So I went off to university, and everybody would say, like, "What did you do at your A-levels? And how many brothers and sisters have you got?"
And you just
feel kind of, you know. But over the years, people asked less, and I had worked out an answer. So I said, I had a brother. He died. Because I tried just pretending to be an only child, but that just made me feel really bad. Once, when I said that to someone, they said in a slightly snarky way, they said, "I thought so. You've got the air of an only child about you."
How rude.
I just was so taken aback with that. Maybe it's right, and I've become, I couldn't even work out what that meant. I thought, well, I'm never lying again. So I would say, I had a brother, he died. And then I would quite quickly say, it was a long time ago.
Taking
the burden on myself of not making the other people feel awkward. So I'd kind of done that. And then I realised, as Matt got a little bit older, that wasn't going to be enough. You know, that wasn't going to be enough for him, and that I was going to have to try and find some words. And that was probably the start of me managing to find some words.
That's incredible. I really like, the sentence you get is just incredible, isn't it? You just learn how to, my dad died when I was 15. And I would just finish it then in a way of like, you don't need to ask about it.
Yeah.
And then like 15, so ages ago, I'm at university now, you don't need to ask, God, who cares about that? Ages ago. Yeah, it was a long time ago. Yeah. No, he wasn't ill for very long. That was good. Yeah, really good. He would have hated that. So So we're all overjoyed that it was a quick death. Yeah, brilliant. The quickness that, and the tone, and most people don't know what you're doing, but they just pick up on the micro expressions, I think, you know, so they sort of go, oh right, I don't ask about that, no idea why. So I think, like, God, those sentences, and for you to have to realise that, my son deserves more. I can't get away with this, I can't. And I've had that with my daughter as well, of like, he's dead. Well, why? And what happened? Like, okay, I'm going to have to think how I tell this to someone I love.
And, yeah.
Or for him to say, is another boy coming? Oh, that made me well up. That's just... And in a funny way, I don't know, this is obviously me. I'm speculating. I don't know you at all. But, like, maybe that's why you did it. That that conversation could continue. That it was, you know, somewhere in your brain, he is still here.
Yeah, he is still present. Very possibly. Yeah. Because, again, the older I get, the more I am happy to accept that I don't really understand anything to a certain extent. Like, I mean, who knows? I don't know why I do things. Quite often I'm, you know, I'm writing a novel at the moment, and every so often I think, like, oh, I wonder if I'm writing this novel because of this. Sometimes I think, actually, that I wrote my first book partly to tell the truth to my son, not that he's read it yet and might never read it. But also, I think I maybe wrote that book to have an honest conversation with my parents. Yeah. And maybe I did that. And maybe I wrote it to keep myself on the straight and narrow in life. Because I'm a great, you know, I am, I didn't used to always be able to do this, but I've taught myself emotional control. Mm. And an actor friend of mine said, she said, you're very good at performing a sane and happy version of yourself. And it's entirely true. You know, and I've trained myself to do it. I can actually have a panic attack in public and no one would know. And I can, you know, I've done events where I've been asked, like, horrendous, horrible questions. I mean, mainly not. Most people are beautiful and respectful. Yeah. And truly, it's the great privilege of my life that people tell me stuff about themselves. But every so often, just... horrible. And I've just trained myself to, like, nod and smile and get myself through it. But again, it's a very useful skill to be able to do that, but it's not good for the soul in a way. So I sometimes think that the reason I write things is to, again, keep myself on the straight and narrow, make sure I'm not just pretending to be all okay, all sort of, you know, jolly hockey sticks, for whatever, for want of a better word, you know, all kind of like happy, you know, like, oh, isn't this nice?
Yeah, like, I just finished my book and it became a lot more memoir-y than I expected it to. It was really, I was like, what's this pouring out of me? Stuff that you thought you've dealt with, that you're like, oh. And it's like, it's hard to explain. I feel like you go into a room and you're like, no, I'm just getting this box. You're like, oh gosh, there's all these other boxes. I better take them with me. Sorry, they are mine. These are all mine. I didn't know I'd left them here. And I feel like, when I finished the book and I read it, I was like, wow, clearly you needed to put all this data, like, I had to sort of put it in an order. Yeah. And that's what I felt. It was a conversation with myself, age 15, to be like, that's what happened to you. Because I was still, even though I do the grief class and I talk about it every week, it's very controlled. I ask the questions, I can edit, I can take out anything about my grief that I want to. Like, if I'm like, oh, I don't want everyone to know that happened, like, whoop. And with the book, I was like, oh, fuck. It's like, you know, you can't lie, can you? It's just like, it's there. And but I feel similar to you that having, obviously it hasn't come out, so I'm in a very pre-birth of book situation. But it helped me deal with so much stuff, like so much stuff just sort of being organized on a page. And it's not to, obviously I'm very privileged. I get to write, someone made me, told me to write a book, but I wanted to write a book, but also like anybody, I think the act of writing it down somehow gives you a control that you don't have in grief at all. And what you were describing about the grief, like, I do that all the time. Like, the silent panic attack it's really bizarre to then leave somewhere with someone and be like, oh, I was having a panic attack. I just did it very quietly. and I wonder if that's partly a combination of someone who's had grief in their life for a long time, because you have to pretend in so many situations that sometimes everything's fine, because if you do have this overwhelming grief, sometimes it's just not the place, is it? Like, you're just in, like, you know, you're at school or you're like at a party and it's like, oh, I can't break down right now, because it's so, like, I used to feel like people will call people. They'll be like, she's not okay. Like, she lost her shit at a party. And I don't want them to call people. So I would learn how to put on, like you said, the sane version of myself and then go home and do it privately. Because it was like, shit, if everyone knows how bad it is, like, they might lock me up.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And of course, I did have a couple of those things early doors, and then thought, I can't do that. You know, I can't do that. So then you learn to sort of stick the old mask on and kind of like, you know, front it up a bit. And yeah, it's such a strange thing though, isn't it? I mean, I often think that that's another interesting thing about having children and watching children. You think that, again, quite often what we're teaching children to do is just lie about how they feel.
Yes, yep, constantly. You're fine, don't worry, brush it off, yeah. Dust yourself down, be yeah. nice to them. Yeah, I know, I try and watch that as well, because it is, you want to, yeah, if you do make the choice to have children and you start seeing how much you encourage them to lie about things.
It's so terrifying, really, isn't yeah. it? And you know, somebody gives them something and they say, I don't like this.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you're kind of like, you know, no, you've got to, and you know, my son's always been good at, again, he'll just say like, so I have to pretend to like it, to be polite. Yeah, and I'm like, well, yeah. Kind of, yeah, actually.
Yeah, yeah. I'm always like, you have to at least say thank you. You don't have to like it. You don't have to play with it. But you just say thank you, because what they did was they bought you something. Like, yeah. That's all you're saying thank you for. But not liking it. Like, yeah. You just say thank you, and then we put it down. Because otherwise, yeah, I know. It's tricky. And I think with grief, it's so... Especially, I wonder if you feel like this, because when you're at that age of experiencing something so traumatic and everyone else is in a very different place. You know, everyone else is like, my life, I'm going off, what am I going to do? Excitement and hope. And so I sort of felt like, oh, it's not the, I can't give this to anyone. And also nobody wants it. Nobody understands it. You know, what do I, it's either be my honest self and have no friends. Yeah. Or like... Oh, I'll come to your party and I'll be a bit quiet in the corner, but I came and I said hello to people and I maybe had a fine time. You know what I mean? Because everyone's yeah. in such a different lane at that point. Did you feel like that?
Very much so. And I think it's one of the things that was... I don't think I almost realised at the time what a big deal it was. I felt I'd really been marked out from everyone else. And, yeah. it, you know, and all my friends... were, you know, it was all sort of like boyfriend stories and interrailing,
yeah.
And I just didn't know how to be with them. I think I was really lucky, actually, because we lived in this pub and I just spent a lot of time with people in the pub, so, which came with its own problems, like later on, because I got this nice boyfriend, and I was thinking about this the other day, and I didn't know how to talk to his parents or the people that they knew, because I just talked to all grown-ups like they were customers in the pub, which actually lots of people didn't really like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I kind of just didn't... So I think I was this... I mean, I was a bit that way on anyway. I actually yeah. always liked the company of grown-ups more than I liked the company of my own age. And I'm a bit better these days, but still, like, I'm actually really... psychologically comfortable with people who are about 20 years older than me. And a lot of the friends, actually, I've made a lot of women friends in the last few years. I used to find, again, women in groups actually terrifying.
Yeah.
And again, partly maybe because of having a brother, I would sort of gravitate to boys all the time. But I've made a lot of women friends in the last few years, but they are often, they're often kind of 10, 12, 15 years older than me. So I don't know, there's something comforting for me in it, I think. So I did always like grown-up conversation, and then just sort of, in, you know, threw myself into that, really. And then just always felt like an outcast or an oddball or a weirdo or whatever with people of my own age.
Well, especially when you've been through something like you've been through, like it's an unusual situation in grief world anyway. And like you said, it's a bit like we were saying earlier about kids, of like, how do you explain, how do you drag someone into the club to be like, look, by the way, where I live, it looks like this. Like, yeah. When they're like, oh, should I go to Berlin or should we go to Budapest? You're like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I did find I sort of gravitated, and still do. I often find out later on, again, that someone I've made friends with or someone I've got a connection with, something bad happened to them when they were 15 to 17, yeah. basically.
Yeah.
And that's a really common thread in my friends. People that, again, know how complex, you know, just know the complexities. Know the complexities of life. I tend to be drawn to them. Then, of course, like, it's not very nice for other people. But one of the things about getting older is that just more people have suffered in their own club.
Yeah.
So there's less of a sense of being... you know, there's less of a sense of being the unusual one, because more people have, you know, more people behind the rope.
Yeah, yeah. I've definitely, as I've got older, been like, oh wow, there's loads of us now. Like when I got here, as we were saying on the show, like I got to the party early, put out the twiglets, There's no one here for ages.
Yeah.
And then it just keeps filling up. You're like, oh, yeah, hi, yeah, yeah. I got here a while ago. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, it's shit. That was exactly me. I like that metaphor, actually. Yeah, so I was like over in the corner with all the old drunks.
Yeah, yeah. They were like, oh, come here, come here.
Some other young people turned
up. And then it's awkward because you're like, oh, I'm actually made really good friends with the old drunks. So
Yeah, these are my people.
These are my people. So you're coming up to, what did you say, like 32 years? Is that, I'm also terrible with maths, so.
Yeah, no, it is. Yeah, since, yeah, incredible.
And do
really.
do you do anything for the anniversary, or has it changed, like?
It's changed, yeah. So at one point, I mean, I used to think it was quite good that I don't, because I'm really not very good with numbers. Like, I think probably like, I don't know, like diagnosably something with numbers. So I feel really fortunate. I've never managed to, I do know the date that Matty was knocked over, but I'd managed to like not know when he died. Like it was summer, but at the time it happened, I was really intentionally trying not to give myself another date in the diary.
Yeah,
The time I've always found most difficult actually is our birthdays. My birthday's in January, his birthday's in February. I still remember, because he was knocked over, and then my next birthday was my 18th, and I still remember it as like a complete shit show.
Yeah.
And just like, I mean, just like awful. And I realise now, actually, that one of the things is that I'm seasonally, you know, January and February are not my happy months.
So, again,
now that I understand myself more and I've had the good therapy, basically, and I don't drink anymore. That was the other thing. I mean, I was drunk for a couple of decades, really. So I've sober since 2017. And therefore, once you stop, amazing. I mean, who knew? Once you stop pouring in, like several pints a day, then you notice other things. Like, this isn't, why do I suddenly feel so miserable? Oh, maybe it's because it's January, and maybe actually spending all of January, all the light hours of January asleep because I'm so hungover isn't very good for me. So that's really eased. And then I used to think of it like nails sticking out and you get snagged on them, the anniversaries. But these days it's kind of, I'm still not a great celebrator. A friend of mine was asking me the other day, actually, because it's my 50th next. Like, oh, are you going to do something? I said, well, I've never yet enjoyed my birthday. So is it really going to change? Because I've now had 50 of them. So again, I was not even aware of this, but I moved back to Cornwall with my family in 2017. And we, because for years we hadn't picked up my brother's ashes. They were at the crematorium. Again, which I felt really bad about. And also, quite often, I wasn't even sure if that was true. I wasn't sure that we might not have done something, but that I'd been so drunk and mad that I actually couldn't remember it. And I didn't dare ask my parents about it. And one of the things that happened over me writing the first book was at some point I managed to kind of like choke out the question. And then my mum just said, no, they're probably still there. We just couldn't face doing the extra thing. Then, of course, I felt really bad about it that we hadn't done it. But I found out that loads of people don't do it. And it just, again, it's just that thing, isn't it? Sometimes it's just the feeling of not being alone. But we scattered them in the sea down here. I didn't feel he wanted to be confined somewhere else. We scattered them in the sea and we just put a plaque on my granny's grave, which is in the cemetery just down the road from my house. So, yes, I managed to move next door to my brother's. So we did that. Then I moved from London. You know, what a surprise. I organised that plaque and then moved so that I could live next door to it, so I could go walking there all the time and kind of... And sometimes I have a sit and sometimes I kind of just wave and walk by and what have you. But that feels like a really nice thing to do. And I wouldn't now, I wouldn't particularly do that like on his birthday. I'd just do it like...
When you feel like it.
And definitely now I'd say I'm more in and out with it. Like, he's not... I remember, actually, because I'm... I think the only reason I know this is because the therapist asked me, like, how often do you think about him? And I mean, it was still all the time. That was probably... I mean, that was just a handful of years ago. It was just all the time. As a, it wasn't that he was all I thought about, but it was like a constant thrum. So it was like, you know, like if you imagine a... sort of a graph, it's that the line was ever present. Other things I could do other things, but that was just a low level, like white noise, tinnitus, that kind of thing. And that's not the case anymore. I do actually have whole, you know, hours, I mean days maybe, where I actually don't really think about it. And I don't feel quite so defined by it as I used to. But again, also, I've just given up worrying about it because I think there are things that happen to you and kind of slightly like, so what if they're going to define me? It would almost be more weird if I'd lived through that experience and not been screwed up by it.
Yeah.
Luckily, because of having great parents and resources and good friends, and I look back, I still find it a miracle that nothing bad didn't happen to me. You know, like when I was off my head and stuff, but anyway, didn't. I was fortunate in the kindness of strangers and the love of friends, and then later on some really amazing therapy, and I'm here, and I, you know, do my work and make my contribution. And I really like now, my latest book is about writing and about writing it all down and helping people to write about things. Again, for whatever, however they want to, not necessarily to be a book, but it might be a book, or just to use writing to do that thing you were talking about, that wrestling of the self, and to have a private space where you can really be yourself. And, you know, those are all the things I think about at the moment. And it doesn't feel like a bad place to be.
Kathy, thank you so much. It was so interesting to talk to you. And remember, Matty, I can't recommend the books enough, especially if you're in the club. I think they will speak to you wholeheartedly. So yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for speaking to me.
It's been such a beautiful and joyous pleasure.
You can find more about Kathy and all the books she's written on her website, kathyreadsbooks.com. You can follow her on Twitter at Kat Rentzenbrink. So that's Kat, C-A-T, Rentzenbrink is R-E-N-T-Z-E-N-B-R-I-N-K, Rentzenbrink. She's on Instagram as well. Her book is incredible. If you haven't read The Last Act of Love, I thoroughly recommend it. Or even A Manual for Heartache and her novel, Everyone is Alive. She's an incredible writer. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was edited by Kate Holland. It was recorded remotely in my living room and Kathy's living room. And the music was provided by The Glue Ensemble. Artwork by Jade Perkin. Stop motion animation by Alice Loveday. And remember, you are not alone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.